by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground.
Welcome to The Manic Gardener, where each week we look at some aspect of organic gardening or at some major issue related to it. This week, it's gardening to support wildlife, which turns out to be mostly insects. I'm Kate Gardner. Be sure to check out the parallel post on the blog, which will have lots of backup information and links. Many gardeners practicing today were raised in an era of zero tolerance for insects and followed a policy of see'em, zap'em. The lone exception being perhaps the occasional bumblebee, since bees have long been recognized as important pollinators, although since they also sting people, maybe not so much. By this time, organic gardeners, a lot of them, have outgrown that stage. And for them, the term beneficial, and for many people, the term beneficial insect is no longer oxymoronic or even moronic. We know, many of us, that ladybugs and lacewings eat aphids. A lot of people know that parasitic wasps lay their eggs in the egg or caterpillar stage of numerous less beneficial insects. But even amongst those people, I wonder how many know that lacewings also dine on a wide variety of eggs and insects, including thrips and mites and scale insects, and on occasion, each other. At any rate, while many insects have now been granted a sort of provisional welcome in some gardens, insect damage is an entirely different matter. That is not to be tolerated. And for many gardeners, insects are still the enemy, and we treat them as such. Now, as an entomologist, today's guest can be expected to have a very different attitude towards both insects and the damage they might do in a garden. Doug Tallamy has become one of the chief advocates for native plantings. It's not because he is a romantic or a purist, far from it. It's because he knows that insects are the basis for all life. His book, Bringing Nature Home, first appeared in 2007 with the subtitle, How Native Plants Sustain Wildlife in Our Gardens. A second edition appeared in 2009 with the subtitle, How You Can Sustain Wildlife with Native Plants. Doug came to his interest in native plants by way of entomology, combined with his profound commitment to conservation. Somewhere along the way, he realized that any two lines drawn from these starting points were going to meet. They would intersect at native gardening. It's a truly symbiotic relationship between many native plants and native insects. The insects can only feed on these native plants, and some native plants, at least, can only be pollinated by native insects. As Doug will explain, this is the basis of the food web. And that's one web that we are inextricably caught in, and we probably shouldn't wish that it would be otherwise. I'm speaking today with Doug Tallamy, the Chair of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware, but better known to most folks out there as the author of Bringing Nature Home. Welcome, Doug. I'm so glad to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
And I wanted to ask you first about the title of that department, Entomology and Wildlife Ecology. That's not an obvious pair there.
No, it's not. That's really a historical accident. We used to be largely an entomology department, but we were entomology and applied ecology. And our applied ecologist was an ornithologist named Roland Roth, and he built a wildlife program for undergraduates that was really successful. So before long, there were more undergraduate wildlife majors than there were entomology majors. So
birds are so much more interesting than insects.
Many people think so, yes. They're not, but many people think so.
Right. So eventually, you had more people in the wildlife than the entomology and changed the name?
changed the name and added faculty members. So now half the department in terms of faculty are wildlife conservation faculty, and the other half are entomology.
And which half are
but
you?
The only, I'm an entomologist, but the discipline that unites these two seemingly unrelated disciplines is conservation. Uh-huh. Everybody in the department is concerned about conserving the biodiversity that we have out there. And in order to do that, we have to conserve food webs. And that's really where my research comes in.
Well, what is a food web?
A food web is it's all of the interacting members of the food web. It starts with plants. Plants are harnessing the energy from the sun and turning it into the food, into the sugars and carbohydrates that everything else uses for energy. Nothing else can eat sunlight, but plants essentially can. So once you have the plants, we call that the first trophic level. And you add the second trophic level are things that directly eat the plants. So we know that rabbits eat plants and deer eat plants, but for the most part, it is insects eating plants that provide the bulk of the protein that fuels higher trophic levels. And by higher trophic levels, I mean other insects that eat insects, but all of the amphibians, the frogs and the toads and the salamanders eat insects. All spiders eat insects. There may be things that eat insects that we don't think of as insectivores, like foxes and black bears.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, 23% of a black bear's diet is insects.
And actually, I was thinking the birds that all those students were so interested in.
Well, that's right. Then we get to birds. 96% of our terrestrial birds rear their young on insects. Or insects and other arthropods, but the other arthropods are largely spiders that, of course, needed insects to become spiders. So so if we just focus on birds, you're not going to have any. You're going to have a very few if you don't have insects in your little food web.
Mm-hmm.
So the more complex a food web is, the more interacting members you have, the more things eating each other and eating those plants, the more stable it is. And stability is good. That means you could add a member or lose a member of this food web, and these days we typically lose members, without it collapsing if it's complex to begin with.
So variety,
food web, variety is good.
Leads to stability.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
It's a redundancy. It's a backup system.
We need redundancy.
If you have something that requires spiders and you have 50 different types of spiders, you could lose one and still satisfy the needs of that one animal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This used to be called the food chain rather than
a lot of people call it a food chain, but then you picture a linear chain, and it's not that way. It's actually a web. So for example, if you have a robin in your yard, the robin is eating lots of different things. It's not only eating one thing below it in a chain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And picture a spider web. That's much more accurate in terms of how food webs actually work.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about these two metaphors just today and how different they are. The one, the chain giving this linear impression, as you say, and how inaccurate that is in terms of dependencies within the animal world. It isn't just one on one.
Well, some food webs are so simple that they do look like a chain, and that illustrates how delicate simple food webs are. If you break the chain in one place, in any place, that's it. You know, it's over.
What's an example of that?
An example of that might be the food web that supports sea otters.
Uh-huh.
Sea otters eat shellfish. They eat abalone and you know, the things on the bottom of the ocean, that sea urchins as well. Those, in turn, eat kelp. So you need kelp to produce what the sea otter needs. If you kill all the sea otters, which we have in the past in different places, then nothing's eating the sea urchins, and they destroy the kelp forest, and the entire aquatic food web, or food chain in that case, disappears. So it's very unstable. You need all the interacting members for it to exist.
Huh. Wow. Okay, that's sobering. So food webs and wildlife ecology, we're talking today about, ostensibly at least, about encouraging wildlife in our gardens. What kind of a food web do we need in order to be able to do that?
Well, let's back up a second and talk about why we need to do that. Most people have gardens to have beautiful plants, and they typically don't want anything in their garden that might eat those plants. And that's because we have started to look at plants, actually we've looked at plants for a long time, as if they were just decorations. And they're there to make our yard beautiful, and that's all they're supposed to do. Now, if there were only a few yards or a few neighborhoods in this country, and everything else was a functioning, healthy ecosystem, that would be okay. We could have lifeless yards that were just there for decoration. But if you go to the internet and look for night lights and look at the U.S. at night, that's shots taken from the space shuttle, you can see just how many people are out there and how many cities and towns we have all over the place, particularly in the East. Everything is just about completely bright.
Yeah.
With developments, which shows you every place there's a light there, we have turned our yards into these very simplified collections of plants, and most of them are from someplace else. They're not the plants that evolved within our local food webs.
Actually,
we just measured it around here. 79% are plants introduced from someplace else.
And when you say someplace else, you mean not the next state over?
No, I typically mean Asia. There are some from Europe, but most of our ornamental plants are from Asia these days.
Like what?
Like what? You name it. Crepe myrtle. Norway maple.
I thought that was a good old traditional southern plant.
It's a southern plant from China, and you're right. It's all over the South because that's about the only thing they plant, but it is from China. Lilac, privet, I mean, all the standard, the azaleas, all the Asian azaleas we use as foundation plants, almost everything is from someplace else these days. So the problem with that is that those plants are not participating in local food webs. And since we have developed almost all the spaces, and the spaces we haven't developed are largely agriculture, we now need to rely on our yards, on our neighborhoods, to sustain the biodiversity that's disappearing very rapidly. And you might say, well, why do we need biodiversity? And that's just all the other species that are out there. And the answer is we need biodiversity because those are the species that run the ecosystems that produce ecosystem services that we humans depend on. Like cleaning our water and sequestering carbon.
This is a yard. This is an artificial thing. I'm not pretending that it's a piece of the woods, and I don't think it's reasonable to pretend that it's wild. What would you say to that?
It's not wild. It's managed. But we can manage it with productive plants. I mean plants that are going to harness the energy from the sun and then pass it on to other creatures. If a plant does not pass it on, in other words, if those other creatures can't eat part of the leaves on the plant, then those other creatures will not be there. And if they're not there all over the U.S., we've just wiped out biodiversity. So that's the problem here. And a lot of people think, oh, if I share my spice bush, for example, with a spice bush swallowtail, it's going to defoliate it. Do you know how many leaves it takes to make an adult spice bush swallowtail? 3. Now, can you share 3 leaves of your spice bush to make a beautiful swallowtail? And I think you can. Most people just, it's an irrational fear of serious insect damage.
Well, I was thinking about this, though, when I was looking at some of the illustrations early in your book, when you're illustrating and that the aliens don't support insect life, whereas the you know, the native plants do. And what you do is you show a couple of leaves from native plants and they're chewed up. There are holes in them. And a lot of people don't want holes in their leaves. So they might specifically go for the alien plants because they don't want holes in the leaves of their plants.
That's right. And I understand that. And it gets back to that notion of thinking of your plants only as decorations. Of course, we don't want anything to touch our decorations. But if you stand back and you look at an oak tree, you see a beautiful oak tree. It's all leafed out. If you went up to that oak tree and looked at any one leaf, there'd be little holes in it here and there. But they disappear when you're looking at it from the distance. And that's the way all the leaves in a forest is are in a healthy ecosystem. It's not serious damage. And what's interesting is that we have actually gone to yards that are landscaped traditionally that have mostly non-native plants with some native overstory trees and compared them to yards that have largely native plants and measured insect damage over a two-year period. And we found, actually to our surprise, that there's less damage on the native properties. Why is that? Because there are so many, there's so much food there that it attracts the natural enemies of particularly. So let's talk about caterpillars, the things that eat caterpillars.
Before we go there, doesn't that contradict what you were saying a minute ago? Because you were saying that the insects don't eat non-natives, but now you're saying insect damage is greater in a non-native garden.
Right. Well, this is, it's a little complicated, but this is how it works. There are more species and a higher abundance of things in the native landscape. But before they get very large, something comes along and eats them. So picture a bluebird pair that is trying to rear its offspring. If they're nesting in their yard, they will go out and collect 300 caterpillars a day to feed their young. Mm-hmm. So they're doing a real good job at controlling the caterpillars that are there. But, you know, when they're through rearing their young, there aren't a whole lot there. I go out looking for them, and it's hard to find them. So why do we have insects in a non-native yard? First of all, most of the insects
That's
we
the
have,
question.
Yeah, most of those we have brought over with those plants. So they're not native insects. The number one pest in suburban yards in the East is the azalea lacebug, which we brought over with Asian azaleas.
Uh-huh.
So it's there. And
what happens if you don't plant azaleas? No azalea?
That's right. It's a specialist. It only eats those Asian azaleas. But, of course, everybody does plant azaleas because we have a very small palette that we work with, very few species. And the reason those lace bugs get out of hand is because they're over here without their natural enemies. And our natural enemies, Those lace bugs in the beginning of the season are not numerous enough. Then there's only one species, so there's not enough variety, enough diversity to maintain a healthy web of natural enemies. Mm-hmm. So once they build up in numbers, some things will come over and start eating them, but they kind of escape predators because the natural enemy complex in a non-native landscape is typically depauperate. They're very, very few there.
So we've taken them out of their food web and brought one other piece of that, the predator on the plant, with them, but not the predator of that insect.
Right.
And so they proliferate.
Exactly.
All right. Okay, saying...
If you look at our major insect problems, it's things like the gypsy moth and the Japanese beetle and the Asian longhorn beetle and the emerald ash borer. Those were things that were brought over here without their natural enemy complex. So they go crazy.
Is the ash also an alien?
The emerald ash borer is an alien insect, yes. And it's a specialist on ash. So it eats ashes in Asia, but it can also eat our ashes because that's what it specializes on. So... this does get complicated. specialists are good at eating what they specialize on, but it's a very, very few number of, just a few lineages of plants that they're good at eating. So another example would be the monarch butterfly. Mm-hmm. It's a specialist on milkweeds.
several milkweeds.
And it can eat a lot of species of milkweeds, but that's right. all it can eat.
Yeah.
So if you take milkweeds out of the landscape, it cannot eat ash, it cannot eat oak trees, it can't eat junipers or anything else. Mm-hmm. And the closest relationships with our native plants are with the specialists that developed on them. The reason the emerald ash borer is killing our ashes, again, is because there are no natural enemies over here, and our ashes have not co-evolved with that particular species, so they don't have defenses against it.
To resist them.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the ashes in Asia are used to that particular insect, and they do have defenses, and they also have the aid of lots of natural enemies that are eating it.
But there aren't any birds over here that have developed a taste for the emerald ash borer?
Well, woodpeckers will eat the emerald ash borer, but only when it gets to be in high densities. It's actually quite a small insect. Mm-hmm. So once the tree is dying and you've got ash borers all over the place, then the woodpeckers come in and start to eat the larvae, but it's too late at that point.
Indeed. Okay. So the question of why we should be encouraging wildlife, because we, as you say, have plastered the landscape with cities, which we can see via their lights from space. And so we can't depend on the wild areas that remain to feed the insects that feed all of us further along in this, out in this food web. Yes?
That's a good summary.
That's a good summary.
You know, we do have natural areas, but they're too small
to do the job.
They're not large enough to sustain. Well, they're going to lose species over time because research has shown that habitat fragments, little habitat islands, and that's just about all we have left. There's a species drain over time. It might take 100 years, but things disappear at a regular rate. I can tell you a story about box turtles in a woodlot at the University of Delaware if you want to hear it.
Box turtles? Sure.
Box turtles, yeah. We have a 35-acre woodlot that has been isolated by agriculture for over 100 years. In 1968, I believe it was, a man by the name of Dale Bray, along with some other folks, caught and tagged all of the box turtles in that woodlot, and it turned out there were 91 of them. And then every year they started to re-catch them and, you know, see how they were doing. Well, that went on for quite some time. But then in 2002, I believe it was, we actually radio-tagged the remaining box turtles and followed them around and looked at sources of mortality. And in 2002, there were only, 22 box turtles left? And last year, there were only 12.
Wow.
So we've gone from 91 down to 12. And the reason is that box turtles leave the woodlot in order to lay their eggs. And when they leave the woodlot, they get mowed, they get plowed, they get squashed on the road. And very few of them make it back into the woodlot. And very few of those eggs hatch. And there's no recruitment into that population. So you just have these old turtles that, they'll live 75, 80 years that have been remaining in the woodlot. But reproduction is essentially stopped. So
they leave to breed.
That's right.
And the reason the instinct is, or the reason behind the instinct would be, in fact, to spread the species. Is that accurate?
No. Or they're just looking for a sunny place. They're looking for a sunny place to lay their eggs because their eggs will do better there.
Okay.
So if it was a large patch of woods that had tree falls and blowdowns where you had patches of sun, you could have a viable population in there that would never have to leave and get squished on a road. But most of our woodlots are too small. The average size of a woodlot in Delaware is only 10 acres, which is tiny. It's not nearly big enough to maintain a population of box turtles or even we've shown this with ground beetles, carabid beetles. We're losing species of carabid beetles from the woodlot as well for exactly the same reason. So over time, the number of species in a 35-acre woodlot will decrease because the populations within those tiny woodlots are too small to sustain themselves when they fluctuate normally.
Mm-hmm.
all populations, you know, fluctuate. In good times, they go up, and bad times, they go down. If you're just a few individuals and bad times come, you go down and you blink out, you disappear.
Yeah.
And then you're gone from that woodlot. And if there's no immigration into it, because these are isolated fragments, then that's it. You're not, that site is not recolonized. Mm-hmm. And of course, if that happens everywhere, then you have global extinction, not just local extinction.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to, that's why we talk about building biological corridors.
That's what exactly what I was thinking, that you need connected land over, even if it's narrow, for long distances.
Well, my idea is to, you know, all the areas between these habitat fragments, I mean, those are our cities and suburbs. That's where we live and work.
Mm-hmm.
So if we get enough plants back into our landscapes, and we measured the what an average landscape looks like in Delaware, it's 92% lawn.
Average, 92% lawn.
92% lawn.
Right.
So, and, you know, that is typical because lawn is our status symbol. But if we were to revegetate, to get plants back into these areas, they would be viable corridors for an awful lot of species.
Mm-hmm.
It still would be tough on the box turtles that have to crawl across that road and get squashed. But many things would do far better than they're doing now if we had productive plants in the areas where we live. And then we could turn those areas into interesting places for ourselves. When I drive around and I look, particularly in the summertime, when kids should be outside playing, and you have these vast lawns, and you can have PlayStations on them and the sliding board and everything, there's not a child outside at all. those are just barren wastelands, and everybody's hiding inside because...
they don't know how to...
Because there's nothing interesting.
Yeah.
There's nothing interesting to do outside. We've eliminated all the interesting things.
I thought about the size of the woods backing the backyard of our tiny, cheap little country place. And the paths that we built there and the games that we played there. And I was like, the thing... I mean, it measured nothing, but it had an enormous impact on our lives.
That's right. And many of us did that. Many of us had those outdoor experiences.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, 92% lawn, that's a bit much. So can we turn now to landscaping solutions? All right, say I'm convinced. What do I do?
Okay. Well, step one is to reduce the amount of area we have in lawn. We have, the latest measure is 45.6 million acres of lawn in the U.S., and we're adding 500 square miles of lawn every year.
Really?
So the problem is getting worse. Yeah, it's not getting better. I would like to cut that area in half. So if you visualize your yard and say, now I'm going to turn half of my lawn into a productive landscape. If we did that everywhere... I always talk about creating a new national park.
Mm-hmm.
We call it Homegrown National Park, and it's just the area that we've converted from lawn. It would be 20 million acres in size, which turned out to be bigger than most of our, well, than all of our national parks, and many of them added up together,
wow.
Including Yellowstone and Yosemite and the Adirondacks the Great Smoky National Park and the Grand Canyon. Denali, all these guys added up together do not equal 20 million acres. So we're talking about a huge area that we could turn into essentially a vibrant national park right where we live. That's the goal. And that all comes from reducing the area we have in lawn just by half. So we're not going to get rid of lawn. We're just going to restrict it to where we walk. That's what grass is good for.
Walk and play? What about croquet or volleyball?
Absolutely. Wherever you're going to do that, you mark out those areas and then landscape the areas where you're not playing croquet or you're not playing baseball or because most of the areas people are not using that way. They simply, lawn has become the default landscaping. We don't know what else to do.
We plant grass.
We plant it in lawn.
Yeah.
Because it's cheap, it's fast, and let's face it, it's easy to maintain it by sitting on a lawnmower.
Right.
And we do that every Saturday.
Yeah, I hate listening to them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first principle then. So the first principle is you map out where you want lawn, where you actively want it, for walking or playing. And you plan on lawn or, I would assume, in, you know, some other walkable ground cover, in fact, in those areas.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be lawn. Mm-hmm. That's right. It can be anything. You're providing a means by which you're going to travel through your landscape. Mm-hmm. Now, why do you want to travel through your landscape? But presumably, it's to see something, or it's to seek privacy, a little cozy. We talk about building outdoor rooms that could give you some privacy, a place to escape.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be a huge area. But what are the walls of those rooms? They're what we call structural plants. The plants that you see during the wintertime, they're still there. So woody plants, for the most part, are trees and are shrubs. Those are the walls of our rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And then the floor, of course, is the grass, but there's a floor everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's one of the problems. If we plant a tree today, we then mow under it. We don't allow that tree to develop a healthy relationship with the ground that it's in. In a forest, the tree will drop its leaves, and those leaves will become incorporated into the ground, and you've got a nice, deep, thick humus layer that's providing nutrients and maintaining moisture and has its own vibrant community of tiny animals and things that are decomposing and recycling nutrients, doing important ecosystem services. We take all that away when we put grass under a tree. And, of course, we shorten the life of the tree tremendously.
Yeah, or
everybody looks at an oak and they say, oh, that's 100 years old. Well, you know, the whiteout group should live 900 years.
Wow.
They never do because they have tremendous root systems. They go out forever. There's a group in England that dug up Quercus robur, the English oak.
Mm-hmm.
It was a mature tree, probably at least 300 years old. They wanted to see how far out the roots went from the middle of the tree.
Yeah.
And they went out 300 yards and quit.
They quit?
That's how far those roots were doing. Yep, they never did find the end of it.
Wow. Okay.
So how many places do we plant a tree where the roots can go 300 yards before it hits
cement,
a driveway, or a street, or a sewer, or something? And that's why our trees don't live as long as they could.
Right. And if I say, well, you know, the roots could go, like, under the road.
They could, depending on what's under that road. And I guess a lot of roots probably do. But those are the obstacles that trees face.
Well, I would think actually going under the road would be problematic because that's asphalt, so no water gets down there.
That's right.
And
and
I'm wondering how viable the soil is.
Well, a lot of it's been scraped away, and they replace it with crushed stone. And yeah, it's not a great place to be, I think. So they probably get truncated there. And another thing we do, I hear all the time, oh, I cannot put a large tree near my house because it's going to blow over. And then every time we have a storm, trees do blow over. So it reinforces that idea. And the reason they blow over is because they are isolated specimen trees. That's not the way trees grow in a forest. They grow together, and they interlock their roots. It's a mosaic of interlocking roots throughout the forest floor, and it's very difficult to blow over a tree in a situation like that. So if we planted our trees not as specimens but as clusters, they would lock themselves in place, and we'd have far less fewer problems from blowdowns. And you could get larger trees closer to your house, provide shade, provide habitat, provide interesting places to be, without worrying about those trees coming down and crushing your house.
I had never heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I'm wondering, I mean, does interlocking branches play a role at all here, or just the roots?
Well, you know, a tree that grows in isolation spreads its branches out and balances itself pretty well. But a lot of times what we do is we'll go into a forest and we'll build the house. A lot of people say, well, I'm going to leave some of these trees, but those trees are straight and tall. And if you thin that out so there's just, you know, one or two straight and tall trees there, those guys are not balanced very well. They're top heavy. So it's another reason that they do blow over, because they're taller. They were tall when they had buddies around them. But when you take the buddies away, that's a dangerous situation, and they'll come down much sooner than they would otherwise.
So the thinning process is problematic. can cause thinning, problems.
Yeah. When they grew in a forest situation, they were all shooting up for the light, trying to get up top as fast as possible. That large spreading oak tree that you see out there that's so beautiful grew up that way. It was in probably in a pasture all of its life. So that's why it's not as tall, and its branches are you know, many of them are heavy and low, and they spread out very far. So it balances and is much more stable in a high wind situation.
Can you say something more about the rooms idea? I actually ran into this on a blog, and it transformed how I was thinking. A blog that Montana Native Gardener, and it transformed how I think about my yard.
Right.
So, which is very small. I live in a city lot in Montana. So much for the big sky. But anyway. Say something more about rooms and you know, an example of how you could do this or something.
Okay. This gets into landscape design.
Yes.
And of course there's no one design for any one property, and designs have to fit the aesthetic values of the homeowner. So it's difficult to describe, this is how you would design that, and I am not a landscape designer either, mm-hmm. but I do know that building landscape rooms is a standard practice that landscapers are always attempting to achieve, just the way you have rooms indoors. And your rooms indoors are built of solid structures, and when you're through building them, then you decorate them. Then you put up the wallpaper and the pictures on the wall and things that attract your eye. What we've done with our landscapes outside is just the opposite. We're using nothing but decorative plants, and we have no structural plants. So the whole system is falling apart, at least in terms of function. So we want to get those functional plants, which are largely woody plants. And I want to emphasize, that depends on where you live. You said you're in Montana. Mm-hmm. I'm in the eastern deciduous forest, and that's why I keep emphasizing these woody deciduous plants. Mm-hmm. If you're in a coniferous forest, that's what you would rely on. But if you're on the open prairie, you're not going to build your outdoor rooms out of trees. That's inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Those plants don't belong there, and they don't want to be there, and they're not going to do well there. But even with a prairie situation, you can build outdoor rooms by having low-growing plants versus taller plants.
Or put up a grape arbor? Or an archway or something?
Yeah.
Sometimes...
Even in the driest areas where there were riverbeds and riparian areas, that's where you had your willows and your cottonwoods and the woody plants that came in, where there was enough water. So you can recreate that situation in an awful lot of our western states.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, what are some other landscaping ideas when you're looking to cut lawn?
Okay, anybody who mows the lawn knows where it's difficult to mow, and that includes all the slopes, the little valleys and troughs and things where it's just difficult to get that mower down to, and sometimes downright dangerous to be edging your way down a slope and hoping you don't slip and fall underneath the mower. So those areas should not be in lawn. Lawn, when particularly in the summertime, when it's dry, becomes really impervious. The ground becomes baked where that grass is, and then you get a storm on top of it, and 75% of that water runs off, and it really runs off on slopes. So we're trying to keep water on site, and grass is not the way to do that. So you definitely want plants that are going to grab the water and hold it on site when you're on a slope. A lot of people won't put a tree on a slope. And I don't know why, because if you climb a mountain, there are trees on all those slopes. They're really good, and they hold the soil. They keep it in place. Mm-hmm. Another trick is, instead of mowing under those trees, to have understory trees and then shrubs under that. You're building plant communities instead of specimen plants. Mm-hmm. Today we are so used to thinking that each plant has to be separated from every other plant, and they can never touch. And then, then we can enjoy the full splendor of that plant. And you can do that sometimes, but we do that all the time now. But we really need to put back our plant communities, plants that know each other, that work well together. So, for example, white oak and kelmia, mountain laurel, do really well together. They both are acid-loving, and it's typically how you would find them growing in some of the more barren areas in the east here. So you find plant communities like that and then reconstruct them in your yard. And those areas, of course, are not lawn anymore. You have maybe instead of a tree and lawn, you might have your tree and then a shad bush as an understory tree, or one of the dogwoods, and then some of the shrubs, the viburnums and spice bush, underneath the understory trees, and you build a whole community. Then you can put your spring wildflowers, your spring ephemerals that want to be in a shaded conditions underneath those plants. Mm-hmm. And you've reconstructed a little ecosystem right there with just a small grouping of plants. Now, those should not be the only plants on your property, but that's just an example of how you can take lawn out of your yard and replace it with something that's attractive and functional. And once it's established, it's lower maintenance. So
that was the next question.
Don't have to mow that.
Because
right.
I know how to mow a lawn. But
right.
you're
yeah.
talking, I mean, some of the, if you're talking to somebody with a lot of acreage, I can see mm-hmm. that the person might feel, well, I'd have to be a professional gardener to do this, and it would take all of my time.
You know, it's an issue. But a lot of people with acreage, what do they do now? They hire a lawn service. And that lawn service comes once a week and takes care of the yard in the same way. Why couldn't we convert some of those jobs into managing the landscape? So they're still managing the landscape. They're just, instead of mowing it, they're making sure that no invasives have come in. If you've planted it correctly, you're not going to have huge weeding problems. But you're right. These landscapes need input. They need to be managed, at least in the visual edges that you see. Mm-hmm. If you have a lot of acreage and you put a lot of plants, you're essentially building a multi-species hedge. You know, what's beyond that hedge is not immediately visible. And you know, do you have to manage that every week? I would say no, not once it's established. But there's no doubt that getting these plants into your landscape is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And it's something I think we should consider kind of a lifetime hobby that we pick at. And if we have let's say we have that crepe myrtle in our yard and it dies, what are we going to replace it with? Well, let's look for a plant that belongs in that ecosystem and replace it with that. Mm-hmm. So even if it's a one-to-one exchange of plants, you've increased the productivity of your yard tremendously.
Okay.
But of course, getting the big goal is to get more plants than we currently have into that yard. So it's not 92% lawn.
Right. All right. Now, say the opposite extreme. I've got a small piece of property. How do I get natives in there?
Okay. You know, small can be real small. And then what I would do is, there's no doubt that when you don't have a lot of property, your options are more limited than when you do. But I've got some examples, some anecdotes of people that have fooled around with small pieces of property to see what would happen.
Yeah.
And one of the best ones comes from a little study that they did in a courtyard in the center of the Department of Ag building in Dover, Delaware.
Okay.
So this is a piece of ground. It's about 15 by 15 feet. And they put a garden in there. And the object was they were going to survey the native bees that would come to the flowers in this garden. That was the goal. And one of the species of plants they had in there, they had several different ones, but one was the common milkweed. But one of the young ladies who planted this garden decided she wanted to see how many monarch butterflies could be produced in the first year after planting this garden in the middle of Dover, Delaware, in the middle of this courtyard surrounded by buildings. And it turned out it was 150 monarchs that went from egg to adult just in that little garden. So not only did they find it, but they used it really productively. So you could say, okay, I'm not going to save everything, but I can sure help the monarchs in a small space like that. And it depends on where you are.
It's amazing. Okay, that's the middle of a city. It's a courtyard surrounded by buildings.
Right.
And a few milkweed plants?
Yeah, I have a picture of it. I can't even see the milkweeds.
How do they find it?
And she did it again the next year and got 150 again. It wasn't a fluke. So some things can be really productive in small spaces.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, You have a small yard, mm-hmm. but so does your neighbor. And if you put them together, it's not quite so small. If you put three neighbors together, then it's even bigger. So if this becomes standard landscaping practice, don't think of yourself as a tiny little island. Think of joining a bigger piece of the puzzle that will make a big picture in the end.
Mm-hmm. It's not just the one effort, it's the combined sum of them.
That's what we're going for, right?
Yeah. Sorry, I am trying to remember something, and I am not remembering it.
I spend most of my day that way.
Yes, I know. Oh, okay. I've got an example question for you, okay? I moved into what turns out to have been the oldest house on my block, all the way back to the 30s. The front of it's a log cabin. There are five spruce trees, large spruce, on the east and southeast side of the front of the house. I have no doubt but that their roots are tightly interlocked. But nothing grows beneath them because almost no rain, almost no water reaches there. Now, I am not, laboring under the impression that nothing grows beneath pines, which a number of people who should know better in this mountain town have said to me. I have a thriving rock garden underneath a pine, but its branches start higher up and it gets lots of light and far more rain. So what I'm wondering is, even in the forest, if you get a bunch of tightly planted or growing coniferous trees, you're not going to get a whole lot of understory.
Right.
So in terms of...
You see that all the time with hemlock forests. They throw such deep shade that there's almost nothing on the ground.
So in terms of plant and insect, et cetera, diversity, would it in fact be better if we had three instead of five such trees? Would they still provide, would their roots help support each other if they were slightly more spaced out, but more light and rain penetrated and therefore more grew on the ground?
Probably. The most productive areas are not deep in the dark forest. They're on the edge where you get a lot of light and you have an ecotone. That's where you find most interacting species. So that's true. If you measure it, that's what you find. It doesn't mean we want everything to be edge because we still value those inner forest species. But where there's light, you're going to have more diversity and more life, so there's no doubt. And you need the light with the rain, but you'll get both of those if you thin those a little bit.
Yeah.
Ooh. But you have to be careful now. If they've grown together, when you take one out, it might leave a hole. You have to do that carefully.
Yep, I'm aware. Okay, well, that's a new way to think about it, indeed. Any other last landscaping tips? Any place where the mower won't go... Take the lawn out.
Right.
Yeah.
I mentioned a little bit about hedges. A lot of people think hedges, you use them for screening. But you can build productive screen. But we think of hedges as monocultures. They have to be one species. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why we have thought about that. But if you build, I call them living walls instead of hedges, out of multiple species, you can still screen out an area. Get a lot of plants into your landscape, but it's now diverse. It's not a monotonous monoculture.
And you could then...
And at least around here, part of the problem with our hedges that we often use privet or barberry or most of the things we use for hedges are highly invasive plants that don't stay where we plant them.
Yeah. Out here, it's carragana.
It's what?
Carragana. It's Russian pea... something.
Uh-huh.
It's quite invasive. Another advantage of that variety would be you could have a variety of bloom times,
for instance.
So instead of having all your lilacs go boom
and
then they're gone,
you
could have more color for a longer time.
More color throughout the season because the leaves will change into a different color. Even if they're conifers, they're different hues. So it's just a more interesting landscape.
All right. Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
All right, now my head is full of ideas. I'm going to have to go out and stare up at those 60-foot-tall spruce.
Yeah, they're big ones.
Yeah, they are, and it just seems evil to take out a large, healthy tree.
Yeah, I sympathize.
Yep. All right, thank you. That's a comfort. Thank you so much, Doug.
Okay, well, good luck.
Thank you.
And good. You know, if you think of other things and you want to do it again in a year or something, just let me know.
I will let you know, indeed. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Doug Tallamy, Chair of the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware, and I will definitely be taking him up on his offer to return at a later date. Now for your gardening tip. For all of you folks who are starting seeds out there, and if you aren't yet, you should be, remember that watering really matters. Moisture matters. It's essential that once a seed has been exposed to water, that it stay moist. But on the other hand, you do not want to drown it, particularly as it sprouts and becomes a seedling instead of a seed. Too much water can literally kill it off and will also encourage fungi and other things that can be downright harmful. If you want a almost complete guide to traditional seed starting, try listening to last week's Seed From Seed to Seedling show with Judy Oswitz. And if you want to try something a little bit different with soil blocks, which are potless blocks of soil in which you can start seeds, you can listen to the show from 2 weeks back with Jason Beam, Potless Planting. That's our show for this week. Be well and garden on.
Pulling weeds and picking stones, man is made of dreams and bones. Feel the need to grow my own, 'cause the time is close at hand. And grain for grain, the sun and rain, find my way in nature's chain, and tune my body and my brain to the music from the land.